Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Despite what others might say, advertising is the lifeblood of podcasts. Today, we have Marshall Williams. His company, Ad Result Media, is reputedly the most influential ad buyer in the industry. Marshall, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Marshall, I'm going to start off by asking you a question. How did you come into this space, and what have you learned about podcasts for our audience, which is made up of small business leaders?
Great question. We are an advertising agency, but especially a specialty advertising firm. And for years, we specialized in radio broadcasting, terrestrial radio, AM and FM radio, where the host of each individual program, whether it be news talk or political talk or sports or, you know, rock stations or what have you, the air personality would do ads in a live first-person context for our clients' products and services. Several years ago, there was a shakeup in the radio universe, and some of our on-air personalities were displaced. Contract negotiations didn't get renewed, or they, radio properties simply needed to cut costs. And we found a few of them who were doing their morning shows or whatever their content was in a digitally delivered on a non-linear, meaning it's not at 9 a.m. in the morning or 6 a.m. or 5 in the afternoon. It was whenever they got around to it. That we began to advertise on those programs, and it worked very well for our clients. And so we began to gravitate more towards the podcasting space, and POD stands for Play on Demand, by the way, a term invented by the Apple people. And it's essentially the same kind of editorial with some different derivations that you might find on radio, but in the on-demand, context of, you know, being delivered through a computer or a cell phone.
Well, at least I learned something new. Now I know what podcast, how it got its name. So, Dan, why don't you take over and ask a couple of questions?
I'll do my best. Marshall, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Let me start off by I was fascinated what you were talking about, how the radio business went through transition. And what you said was something that I've been writing about in my commentary a lot. I just finished a piece on the gaming industry. And what you said is that the American consumer wants to decide what they want, when they want it, and how they want to get it. And so that the podcast is, I understand this business, the podcast creates the opportunity for people like Don and I to have a regular radio program, but also to build a constituency using the podcast idea that allows that customer of ours to, and we think of those customers in addition to listeners, to sign on anytime they want. And what do you, knowing that and knowing you're an avid supporter of it, where do you see that podcast movement going?
Great question, and I want to go back to the first part of what you said is how the consumer absorbs the product. It's on a as-wanted basis where they want it, okay? the proliferation of the smartphone has allowed us to put and consume data in a super mobile environment. And people who want to consume certain types of content, in your case, the business, small, medium business kind of content, may not have the opportunity to listen to it between 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. in the morning on a particular day of the week. And forgive me if I'm not sure of when your show actually airs, but what this mobility and this consumption through this mobile phone has allowed them to do is to consume your content when they're on the road driving at a later time, or when they're out walking the dog, or when they're driving carpool, or any of those other opportunities. So to answer your question directly, the expansibility of it, if that's the proper word, the expansion potential is staggering. The original podcast consumers were young for the most part because they grew up with this phone in their hand. It was ubiquitous with their life and how they consume things. Now it's gravitating towards an older generation. And the levels of growth in the podcast space are phenomenal at this point. There are shows out there that have achieved, you know, 1 million individual downloads, which is a listened, over the first 10 days of their lifespan. And heretofore, that is a number that was almost impossible for a broadcaster to reach with that kind of speed.
Well, you know, when we Don and I had another program on another network, and it was internet radio, and it was political commentary. And as Mr. Trump became president, Don and I were talking about what's the implication of Mr. Trump. And I, being a money manager, I believe that that the previous administration had intentionally tried to hold the economy back. And I said, I think there's going to be a huge opportunity for small business because people were not willing to take risk under the Obama administration in the way they classically have. And we thought there would be a market for people who are interested in owning, starting, or running a small business. And we started in February with virtually no footprint whatsoever. And we just got our number. We're about 140,000 downloads a week, not counting On Air or iHeart or Roku. So we think we found a niche. And because the economy is changing, there's probably lots of other niches. But finding that niche helps create content. And I think you'll probably agree with me, but isn't content still king?
It absolutely is. Couldn't agree with you more. And what our company does, what Ad Results Media does, is we connect the content creator, people like yourself, and the advertisers. Our model exists around, as mentioned earlier, we would have these on-air personalities on these radio stations endorse a product or service, whether it be pro flowers around Valentine's Day or Mother's Day, or AT&T telephones, AT&T mobile, mobile service, or any number of ZipRecruiter is a brand of ours. There's a company in the mailing and shipping space named Stamps.com. What we have done is take that connectivity between the client and their service or product and connect this influencer. That's the modern term. The influencer is the host of these programs, and there's literally hundreds of thousands of them out there, and have that host do a educated, informed ad, an editorial perhaps, but it does include an advertising message in it about what they love about that service and what they love about that product, and then we put a call to action in. Go to this website, download this your mobile app, or that kind of thing. And I'm excited that you guys have seen that kind of growth in such a short period of time, because it just goes to further the quick-paced growth of this segment of the broadcast space.
Right.
From an audio standpoint, this is the most exciting space out there right now.
Yeah. Marshall, we had on our previous show, we had a gentleman who founded a company with video cameras, and they're all battery-operated, and he sells them for security for small business or for your home. And after, just as we finished the show, I said, "Abby, would you think about a special offer for our listeners?" And he jumped like he was. It was like the best thing since sliced bread. I think that with the idea of creating something special for a listener on a program that relates to their business, in our case, is going to get a lot of traction. And finding the right match, and somebody like your company, Marshall, can help. I never thought of myself as an influencer, but now I got to rethink my brain here a little bit. But finding the right combinations, if you would, of relationships where they get the greatest synergy for the consumer and also for this for the sponsor for the program. And I can
right.
see where that could create a huge opportunity for you and your company.
You know, and yours as well. So my compliments on building out a robust platform right now in such a short period of time. I can just imagine one of our clients, Stamps.com, which is a shipping platform. You may have heard the ads out there. They've been around
I've
for
used
some
it.
Time.
It's I a, use it.
Yeah, you telling a small, medium-sized business person that they don't have to go to the post office anymore and that they can get accurate postage and they can. There's a scale on their desk that integrates with their computer. They can simply print the postage off, put it on the package, and then go as far as to hit a pickup button, and then the U.S. Postal Service person will come and pick up their packages from their place of business. That is a fantastic alignment there, and great opportunities for our clients and your show as well.
Yeah. I have a foundation, Songs and Stories for Soldiers, where we ship out MP3 players to veterans all over the country. We use them all the time. I mean, it's my sister puts the packaging together. She calculates the postage, puts it on, and calls the post office, and they come and pick it up. I mean, it's a great service. So, what other kind of companies do you think are ideal in the pods casting space? You've mentioned Stamps.com and others. What other things are you thinking that have tremendous growth opportunities?
That's an excellent question because. When we were traditionally in the radio space, and we still do a great percentage of our business in the terrestrial radio space with the large broadcasters, the CBSs of the world, the iHearts, which I know you guys are on, and Cumuluses, et cetera. We still do a large percentage of our business there. But traditionally, those targets were business to consumer. Pro Flowers would advertise to the person who needed to send flowers at Valentine's Day to their sweetheart or mom on Mother's Day and that kind of thing. So the end user tended to be the consumer who was going to, conduct the transaction.
Right.
What we found in the podcast space, as we've gotten into more of this, there is a better opportunity to reach a business owner, a small to medium business owner, who could consume a product like ZipRecruiter when they're looking for new hires or to fill job opportunities. Stamps.com, same kind of context. We have a company named Betterment, which is it's one of these new automated financial service companies where you can host your 401k if you have a small to medium-sized business and have retirement plans for your employees. They will do it on a web-based, totally separate from having to have an individual in your office manage it. They'll manage it, they'll execute it, it's really a remarkable product and so much easier to have a cloud-based program than to have it internally and cheaper.
Yeah.
So there is a great opportunity to reach this business-to-business owner as well. That's an expansion on what we've seen from a radio standpoint.
I would like you to look in your crystal ball because I can't tell, but Don, do I have time for one more question before we hit a break?
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm curious as to you've talked about where you see the podcast industry going. Where do you see that the typical over-the-air AM/FM stations, where is that going?
That's an excellent question. Because, there's a lot of questions about, okay, you got these large ownership groups and what are they going to do? Because radio seems to be a medium that that is not being consumed by this younger generation. Well, it still is, and it's still growing. It's just growing at a slower pace than it had in, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. Okay? It's
yeah.
still the best opportunity for people to be introduced to new music. It still has the largest political talk programs that are out there. Radio is transitioning into a more digitally delivered space. The iHeart has an iHeart app and things like that. And I think you're going to see those groups begin to create content specifically for the digital space, for this podcaster on-demand space. And so I think as they pivot, they're going to get more nimble. They need to. You'll see more and more of their traditionally radio-based on-air talent move into the digital space. I think that is something we'll see in the future. I'm hopeful that that is something we'll see in the future because they have great talent and great content.
Michael, I'm going to take a break here.
Okay. All right, take a break, okay. And I'll ask you another one when we come back. Thank you, sir.
We're talking with Marshall Williams, whose agency, Ad Results Media, is reputedly the most influential ad buyer in the podcast industry. We're talking with Marshall Williams, who runs an agency, Ad Result Media, who is amongst the most influential, if not the most influential, ad buyer in the podcast industry. I'd like to jump in here with a question, Marshall, if I may, and ask you, our audience is made up of small business owners in many, many different fields. What are the opportunities for them to create a podcast that might be of interest? And what do you see needs for?
One of the great things about the on-demand podcast digital space is that it's allowed so many more voices and points of views and interests to be addressed. There was no real way for a consumer who had an interest in rugby or something that was fairly niche to produce and create a radio program that exists. The internet has allowed all these people to get into the space that heretofore didn't have the technology or the means or what have you to enter that space. There's a lot of interesting content out there that's very niche in nature, as mentioned. There's cooking shows, there's wine shows, there are golf podcasts, there are podcasts about specific industries that are highly specific. There are doctor health segments about certain components of the medical community. And the audiences may not be, you know, enormous, but the people who listen consume it very readily and they're very sticky relative to the content. So I think the podcast space allows a lot more people, including small and medium-sized business people who can offer information, content, advice, reviews, et cetera, on their particular niche in the business space. It allows them a voice out there that heretofore they couldn't, it wasn't available for them to get their voice out.
I'd like to ask one more question, Dan, because I'd like to talk about cost. One thing about podcasts, they're relatively inexpensive to start and run. They take a lot of time thereafter. What are your thoughts on that, Marshall?
The barrier to entry is relatively low. We made jokes early on about this guy does a podcast in his garage or in his basement. And they weren't necessarily jokes because the initial entry point from a technology standpoint is a laptop and a microphone and that kind of thing. So the barrier to entry is very low. As you get to see some scale in your podcast, it does. The ones that do well are the ones that are produced relatively in a high-level fashion, and that is more expensive to execute. But the entry is cost to entry there is relatively inexpensive, and the ability to monetize it in our context, okay, because we're an ad buyer in this podcast space. the ability to monetize it is pretty strong, because we've had clients who called us and said, for whatever reason, we have a large percentage of our buyers who are rugby fans, okay? And so we sought out rugby podcasts. Now, some of them are international and such, but where else in the universe would you be able to find a program concentrating on rugby that these people could do ads for our clients in? It's a remarkable space from that perspective.
Dan, back to you.
Well, Marshall, I have what I hope you'll believe is a great story that I give you permission to tell. 2 weeks ago, I do radio and television, and I've been a regular on the China Global Network Television, and I have to go up from Sanibel to Tampa. It's a 3-hour ride, and my driver, the driver who picked me up 2 times ago, he has a podcast. Now, think about this, Marshall. He has a podcast of 1950s to 1960s polka music. And he's been doing it for like 10 years. And he's now on podcast. It's 1 hour. He loves doing it, and he loves playing polka music. He has a huge collection. But you were talking about how segmented you can be. There's an example of a guy who's doing what he wants to do. He drives a car, but he also loves to play polka music for people who want to listen to it. Anyway, let me move on. You've got, from what the way you have described it, there is some disruption in the traditional radio space, and part of that disruption is caused by the podcast. As Don mentioned earlier, we're kind of going both ways. We're on 12 radio stations, but we also have a good size audience that's coming, growing every month on podcast. So we're doing kind of both. And is that a challenge? Is that difficulty to promote somebody who's in both medias, or is the on air simply a bonus to what they're doing with podcasts?
I think both of them. I think it's a bonus. Because I think the you'll have a certain percentage of consumers. Let me back up just a half step. Podcasting is still in its infancy from an industry standpoint. Mm-hmm. And there's enormous levels and numbers of people out there who aren't even aware of what a podcast is. Okay? And as it becomes more mainstream, as it becomes more accepted out there from a way to deliver media or content, the audience is going to grow. There are consumers, as you mentioned, who or that as your show is presented, who traditionally listen to radio and they consume your product from a radio standpoint, which is great. I think the addition of radio with podcasting is very fortunate on your guys' part, because it's going to bring a new element of people who might not have been able to hear your terrestrial radio program because they weren't available, it was on a time that didn't work for them, wasn't right. On an affiliate nearby. Now they have the opportunity to consume it on a digital, as wanted, as needed, and convenient basis. So I think you guys are in a very good spot.
Well, I appreciate that. Let me go back, focus on you again. As somebody who's a visionary in this business, Are you finding it easier or still struggling to convince traditional sponsors to think about podcasting?
Fantastic question. There are two sort of we are a performance marketing agency. So when we advertise on a particular show, we try and track what kind of response we get from it. Okay, we might say enter my media code at checkout. And we try and get a handle on how well it performs from a dollars spent standpoint. From a performance standpoint, we look at the podcast space as it's exceptional in terms of the level of performance our clients see from it. okay?
Mm-hmm.
The big branded advertisers that we also work with, and we've worked with Nestle over the years and Purina Pet Foods and AT&T and a few other big branded companies, they tend to still look at podcasting as a niche, oh, wait till it gets some scale to it or what have you. So we're waiting on those big branded companies to come to us and say, we think this is a viable option for us. We want to really get into the space. Then you're going to have some real changes in the industry, because the way the branded companies, the big automakers, the big packaged food companies, or the big packaged product goods companies like Procter & Gamble, the way they buy media is much more broad scale. So it will change the landscape. It will be our performance marketing companies, the ones I mentioned earlier, that track their leads are still going to be an element of it, but you will also have Ford Motor Cars, and you will also have, you know, Procter & Gamble products, and, you know, Purina Pet Foods and things like that in the space. So we're excited about what the upside potential is here in this space. But that's what the landscape looks like right now.
Marshall, we had a guest a few weeks ago who's in the what they call the FinTech business, which is alternative banking to finance small business. And he said when the market collapsed in 2008, the banks just walked away from the small business market. Now that the economy is starting to come back, the banks want to get into the business, but they found that this whole new group of people who are non-bank banks have taken over their space, and now they're really having to fight to try and get small business back into the bank. They love advertising. They love talking about their opportunity to small business on programs like ours, because they don't have to fight with airspace, and they don't get a 30-second spot. They get 15, 20 minutes, 25 minutes to talk about what they do, so they can have a real conversation with a potential borrower. That's one of the things that this space I see is one of the best advantages of the pod system, is that you can give us a sponsor and we can be talking about whatever it is they're doing, not for 30 seconds or a minute. We can do that kind of commercial, but we can have people on for the company and talk about what they're doing and make an impression in 12 markets that they may not be in or not doing things. And I think that's a tremendous leverage for the podcasting business.
Right. Agreed. And the great thing about the way podcasting or who consumes podcasts is they are, as you mentioned, they're the people who listen to it are wide open to these new opportunities. Like you mentioned,
yes,
the non-bank bank. Okay.
Yeah.
The cloud-based, money management company where you don't have to have a representative at a brokerage firm. They'll handle your investments or 401k in a cloud-based platform. We have another company that's in the insurance business. No agent needed. You call, it's a company called Policy Genius. You call Policy Genius or you go to their website, you fill out a form. They submit back whatever kind of insurance quotes you might need, life insurance, health insurance, et cetera. It's remarkable how well this new brand of, business that's outside the traditional realms that we've known it, like a brick-and-mortar bank.
Yeah.
It's remarkable how well they're doing in this space. So I'm excited about
it. We have, Marshall, we find that Don, who does almost all the legwork, we're into November as far as schedule. Yeah, and as more and more people hear about the show or listen to the show who are in business who want to get into this space, we get contacts. And so we're building a network going out into the end of the fourth quarter of people wanting to wait in line to get on our program to talk about their product or service. I mean, it's education. It's fascinating for me. And it's a new medium that I learn every day. And I agree with you. I'm not as well versed in it as you are, but I see, it's the whenever we talk to advertisers about the everybody wants to know what our podcast numbers are. And they don't care about the fact that we're right now in about 4 million households around the country in our 12 networks. That's like, okay, that's fine, but we really want to know what your podcast numbers are. Like, the on-air is almost worthless. They're more interested in the pod numbers. And I think, if I understood you, people like us are people that are looking to expand their business. Don't give up the possibility of using both.
No, not at this point. As mentioned, I think terrestrial radio still has some legs. The podcast space is growing at a much faster rate, though. And I think that's part of the reason we're getting that kind of feedback.
Don, do I have room for one more question?
Marshall, I was going to jump in and ask you, because somebody just emailed me across the desk. If you're a small business and you want to advertise, how do they reach you? And how do you see smaller businesses utilizing podcasts?
I think there's a tremendous amount of possibility out there. Podcasting, one thing about podcasting we have to consider is that there's no geographic or regional limits to it. A podcast could easily be heard in London, England, as it can in Connecticut, okay, or Las Vegas, Nevada, or Bakersfield, California. So a small business would have to consider that when thinking about the space. If they have a product or service that they would like to market to a universal audience in a particular vertical or niche, there's lots of programming out there. It's also the cost to advertise is all dependent upon the scale of the particular show. And so since there are plenty of shows out there, and literally thousands and thousands of them, there are probably opportunities for a small to medium business to test in a cost-effective fashion. What we do when we start with smaller shows first, increase the level of spend that we have with those shows or increase the breadth of shows that we have as we see it working, and then grow from there. We believe in incremental growth where we prove out the success and ratchet up the marketing dollars as we've seen that success. You can learn more about our business. Our website is adresultsmedia.com. And if you do want to contact us, there's a contact tab on that website, adresultsmedia.com. That's ad with one D. There's a lot of good information there about how we execute and things like that. And so I would encourage any of your listeners who might want to find out more about this to go to the website and check it out.
Okay. And Dan, you get to ask the final question.
You kind of took away my thunder, and that's okay. I was just curious as to if Marshall has, if I could maybe stretch the question a little different way. Where would somebody who's never done a podcast, should they go to somebody else before they go to Marshall Williams, or should they come to Marshall Williams?
We're the leader in the space there. I know you would expect me not to say anything else. I certainly would hope so. But we do maintain about a 35% to 40% market share in that space. And that allows us the opportunity to have first right at new content. Our pricing structure is preferable.
Yeah.
The way we execute is systematic and pretty seamless. And our customer service levels are solid. We believe in taking care of our customers pretty well.
Yeah.
And it works. That's the other thing, and I don't want to.
That is clearly the element of the internet that Don and I have noticed. The big box stores, the malls, have forgotten how to take care of their customers, and the online service providers bend over backwards to take care of their customers. And there's a huge difference between the two, and it seems to be growing all the time.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, a lot of these online companies have figured out that is the more responsive you are to your customers, even if it's a we'll look after it, we'll get on it if you have a problem, that kind of thing. They very much the consumer very much gravitates toward that. I agree with you about a lot of that.
We've been talking with Marshall Williams, the president of Ad Results Media. perhaps the most influential ad buyer in the podcast industry. Marshall, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been illuminating to me, and I hope to our audience as well.
Thank you, Marshall.
Happy to do it. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
Do we have our next one? Do we have Chris?
Marshall, I see you're still on. Thank you so much.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Marshall, what's the next steps? I want to ask him what the next steps are.
Well, it's based on what he was saying. He likes what we have.
Yeah.
Because our uniqueness is both the over-the-air and the podcast piece.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting to him. And he's looking at two, possibly three potential sponsors. And the pricing at $250 seems reasonable to him.
Yeah. Well, that's the important thing that I got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's somebody.
Hello, this is Chris.
Hi,
hello,
Chris.
There.
Dan Perkins, how are you?
Hey, guys, I'm well. How are you?
Okay.
Good. Looking forward to talking with you.
Hey, same here.
Okay.
I apologize. My earlier meeting ran just a little long.
Okay.
I just want to make sure that you were supposed to be on. So we're set. We're going to have a 5 minutes, 5 seconds or so quiet so that for our engineer, and then we'll go, okay?
Okay. Sounds like a plan.
It's Telemetrics?
Telemetrics, correct.
Okay. Chris Powell.
You got it.
Our next guest argues with some hard facts that employee wellness programs can add profits to a small business. Chris Powell, who is CEO of Telemetrics, joins us now. Chris, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm going to start off by asking you the basic question. Why do you say helping employees with a wellness program can add profits to a small business?
Well, you know, if employees, here's why I say that, right? So if you think about everything that happens at a company at some point requires employees or people to do something. And so if people are able to show up and be in their best shape or live in their best lives, that puts them in a better position to bring their best game to work, meaning bring their talents, their time, and their creativity to work. If you've got an employee population that is not well, you've got a lot of absenteeism, lower productivity. So that's why we say, hey, investing in wellness is a really good thing, in particular for small businesses where we tend to have to ask more of our people because we have fewer people. So you want to make sure that everybody's at their optimal level of physical and mental performance.
Well, what does your company do?
So at Telemetrics, we are a company focused on helping other companies capture and aggregate talent data from their employees around their experience to help them, you know, get better at improving employee retention, engagement, performance, and productivity through the use of data.
Okay, when it comes to data, I turn it over to Dan. He's the data expert.
So, Dan, are you the numbers man?
I am the number guy. I'm a registered investment advisor, been managing money for almost 44 years, so I'm the number cruncher. So where is your company located, Chris?
We're located in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, down the road from where I was born and raised in Columbus.
Down the way.
Yeah, and so what is your – do you have a company have a website?
Yes, we have a website. We're at www.telemetrics, TALMETRIX.com.
Okay. And how long have you been in business?
Let's see. We were originally started in November of 2008. So we're coming up on 9 years.
10 years. Almost 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So who is the typical kind of customer that you would have today?
So our typical customer today is a organization somewhere between 300 and 5,000 employees. They typically, some would call that small to medium-sized company. They tend to be either going through a series of events in their growth, either high growth or retrenching and coming out of a turnaround situation, or doing a lot of mergers and acquisition work, or driving a lot of new innovation. So one of those four things are happening with the clients that we companies we tend to work with.
How do you, as a small business, how do you get a new client?
Oh, my goodness. Smoke signals, drum beats, all kinds of things. So we use, we go old-fashioned from cold calling to referrals and relationships to actually doing both inbound and outbound marketing. So we use all of the social marketing tools that are out there, from Google AdWords to Facebook to LinkedIn to Twitter, to be able to put out thought leadership as well as product marketing to attract customers.
So would you say that your business is in the business of providing services on a retainer or a project basis?
Because we're a technology platform, Dan, it's more on what I would call on a retainer basis or on a subscription basis, as we would describe it, where
okay.
a client engages us, you know, on a 12-month or 24 or 36-month basis to be able to provide the technology and service and support that we can help them in collecting that talent data to generate these unique insights.
Mm-hmm. Given the change that's taken place, we had a period of time where we've talked to people over the last few months, probably now 7 months, who talked about how difficult it was to do business, to grow a business and do business in the period of the Obama administration. They didn't see the Obama administration as being very business friendly. Yet the momentum and what we're hearing from people who are in the business-to-business space, they're telling us, as we're doing interviews with them, four of them a week, that things have changed dramatically under the new administration. And not so much that the government is doing so much as the enthusiasm for opportunity by the business owners is growing. Are you seeing that in your business?
I'm definitely seeing that there's more activity, but I think I've got a, you know, kind of a unique perspective being here in the state of Ohio and Cincinnati, which I came into this business about 4 years ago, and I was pleasantly surprised, you know, all a bit of what I was seeing in other places, how progressive both the city and the state here were being in terms of supporting economic development, in particular with early stage businesses like ours. And so I don't quite get, I understand in general kind of the bigger issue, but here locally it was a tale of a different story per se. But I can say now there's definitely a lot more energy and momentum around economic development and creating jobs and growth, in particular in the small and mid markets, and you know where I am, and in the fact that I'm in technology, STEM related businesses are also getting a lot of attention, which I like because that helps me.
who would be a typical competitor?
So. In our space, I don't know if we've got a direct head-to-head competitor. We have what I call near competitors, people that play in parts of our space but not our full offering. So we run into, on the employee engagement or employee culture and doing those kind of projects and work. We run into companies like, CultureAmp and Glint and Tiny Pulse HR. So you'll see some of those companies out there. And OfficeVibe is another name that's fairly well known in that space. But then in terms of what we're able to do with data, in particular around HR and talent data, there's companies like Vizier that play in our space as well.
Mm. I'm curious as to your position as it relates to employee health programs.
Mm-hmm.
Does your company actually work with an individual employee and develop an exercise plan, a lifestyle plan, or diet, or whatever? Do you do that?
Given our size right now, we've got 16 folks that work with us day in and day out. We don't do that at our level, but our partner or vendor that we picked to provide our healthcare plans, Humana in this case, they mm-hmm. offer those services for our employees to participate in those. And there's a benefit to us that when the employees are participating in some of these programs that Humana offers in the area of wellness and health, they can actually earn points and get discounted on their premiums, which drives our cost down and drives their cost down. So there's mutually benefit. So we don't offer it directly, but our provider does. And let me tell you, I champion and highly suggest and recommend people take advantage of it. Not
yeah.
because it's the right thing to do from a health standpoint, but it also helps us in terms of our cost structure, being able to provide other benefits to them as well.
When you're working with your healthcare providers like Humana, do you get a lot of pushback from employees about wanting to do something, or is there an increasing concern about personal wellness?
Well, I got to tell you, Dan, recently, I'll just give you a little story. On our side, I think the employees have liked being able to have a resource or a tool to be able to, tap into these offerings from Humana. But the other thing that came out of it recently, a couple of the folks on the team came to me and said, hey, Chris, I've been signing up for this yoga class that's, five blocks from the office. I'm wondering, hey, can we offer a yoga class here once a week? And I was like, well, let's figure out how many people. So guess what? On Wednesdays at 12 o'clock, we offer yoga every week now. It's a good thing. I'm all for it, as long as it's, people are taking advantage of it, they're getting some benefit out of it, and it's helping raise all the boats rise together with it.
Dan, I have to interrupt for a second. We're talking with Chris Powell, who's CEO of Telemetrics, and we have to stop here for a brief word from our sponsor. We're back with Chris Powell, who is CEO of Telemetrics. What can I say except he's a data-driven company? We're learning a lot. But, Dan, could I jump in and ask a question?
Sure.
How long Chris, how long have you been in business?
Yeah, so we've been in business since 2008. Initially, we started off as a consulting firm, and in 2013, we pivoted to a software technology company.
Well, in that time, what are the three things that you might pass on to our small business listeners? You're in the healthcare space. 1/6 of our economy is. But in general, what would you want to pass on to our listeners?
I think for anybody that's running, managing, or owning a small business today, I would say that the earlier you can understand the people who are working for you and understanding what their needs are so that they can show up and perform and produce and deliver the level of service that you want them to, is understand who they are and what they need. I think oftentimes in small businesses, because we think they're small, we know everything, and sometimes I think we forget to ask. So I would say in terms of trying to figure out what to offer your employees to drive, you know, engagement or retention or whatever, ask the question. Don't rely on the water cooler get your insight. So get the facts, not the gossip, as I call it. And then the other thing is that, you know, the diversity of the people that are working with you, and I'm not just talking about the obvious physical diversity that we bring to the table, but the needs of people are uniquely different. And I used to think that most people wanted the same thing, but I quickly realized they don't. So I think back to the whole listening thing and understanding what drives and motivates people is really critical for small business owners, as it is for any owner. But then for a small business owner, I think it's even paramount because you've got to be really cost conscious on how you offer those things and then do it in a way that meets where you are in terms of your financials and your goals that you're trying to set for yourself. So I think it's a little more challenging for small business owners, but it's not impossible to get it right.
Back to you, Dan.
Thank you. Chris, I want to ask hopefully not too an uncomfortable question for you, but I need to ask it anyway. How did the implementation, and I'm going to use my bias, the bastardization of Obamacare and the plethora of changes in the rules, how did that affect you and your business and your customers?
Well, it's like any game, right? So if you guys can remember when you were a kid and you went to a neighborhood to play kickball or any sport, right? You mm-hmm. have the rules that you knew from your neighborhood of how to play that game. And then you go to another neighborhood and there are different rules. And I think the challenge for Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act or, you know, whatever name you want to give it, I think the challenge for small businesses was the changing dynamics around what was required, what wasn't required, what was real fact, what wasn't, what was perception. So I think a lot of it was just massive confusion. And let's not even get into the cost factors, right, which was another issue for small businesses, I think. So I don't disagree that, you know, there was a lot about the Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act that just, you know, it's not the word negative, just to say it was an issue that could have been better managed, and I think it just put more complexity on the small business owners. I think the larger companies where I've worked had more resources and tools and lawyers to be able to figure out how to navigate that, but for small businesses, it was quite confusing.
Dan, I'd just like to interrupt here and say one thing. The example that you used with the kickball is one of the best I've heard in all the years of Obamacare. Chris, you'd be... don't you agree, Dan? We've heard a lot of explanations, but
sure.
But that's a really good one, and I just I couldn't let that pass.
Well, I think it was a keen observation because what Chris is saying is nobody knew what the rules of the game were.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what the rules of the game are, you don't know how to play.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, I look at it always, if I know what the rules are, then I can figure out what my strategy is. But if the rules are like sand and I'm always moving, it's just like I got, you know, it's a different set of muscles and different things you have to do.
Yeah, it seemed to me that the administration philosophically knew what they wanted to do. Administratively, they had no clue. And they could not give any guidance to you or the insurance companies or to the employers about what was they're supposed to do. They changed all the time.
Yep. And we know from experience around this call is in the absence of clarity, we know what happens. People start assuming and things start to take on a life of their own, and true or not true, but it just, you know, it just messes, you know. Let's just say, I can go on and on.
Chaos.
Oh, that's a good one. Thank you. I like that one.
No, it was just Dan and I have been for years talking about Obamacare. but I've seldom heard one explaining it so clear than that. I just could not pass, and I intend to steal it from you, Chris, it's so good.
No, have at it. And so the thing for me that was interesting over the last couple of months as Congress was trying to do the repeal and replace or whatever different five or six different versions that we went through in that short period of time, even that started to create some more confusion for small business owners because, you know, you're sitting there like, well, what, should I plan for this? Should I plan for that? So I, you know, the lack of leadership, you know, between either, you know, either party or administration on this, I don't think they understand the ripple effect of the noise that they create for small businesses because we got businesses to run. You know, we're not sitting around being policy wonks and trying to figure this stuff out. We're trying to figure out how to deliver the goods and services and, you know, engage and retain our employees. And, you know, I just don't know if there's always an appetite to think about the small business owner who's trying to figure this stuff out while still growing the, you know, growing their business and the economy, because we all know that small businesses are what makes America what it is today.
Right.
So it's amazing. I'll get off my soapbox.
It's all right. It's amazing to me, Chris, that we're dealing with politicians, many of who have never written a paycheck. Mm-hmm. They've never had to hire anybody or fire anybody. So they don't really know what it means to be a small business. And they, it's amazing to me, Chris, the number of times when they run across something, well, I never knew that, or I never thought about that. You know, it's your policy wonks. It's lack of experience. And they don't understand that the big lobbying efforts may be with a big corporation. But as you pointed out so rightly, the people who make this country grow are the small businesses, people under 500 employees. That's mm-hmm. where the growth in America comes from. So I have a soapbox, too. How much time do we have left, Don?
Hey, a fellow soapboxer. Boxer. Love it.
Don, how much time do we have? Well, so what do you see, Chris, what do you see the challenges for your business going forward?
The challenges going forward, I think for us is the rate of change is accelerating so fast out there in terms of technology. One is just making sure we've got the right people. And when I say right people, and for us, that means people who, you know, are coming out of STEM-related, you know, careers or background or education, who understand technology and all the advancements that are coming with that. You know, we're fighting, you know, here in Cincinnati, we're going up against big companies like Procter & Gamble and Kroger and Macy's and, you know, God knows who else for talent. And so we just need more skilled talent to continue to drive innovation because we all know innovation happens through people. And I know a lot of people want to say computers do it, but people program computers. So it starts with people. So we need more people that are able to be and do things so that we can continue to innovate in this country, I think. So I that's one of my big challenges, I think, for our business is being able to have the right people to, you know, to do the type of jobs we need. And my business grows when there are other businesses out there that are growing. So more businesses growing would be helpful, too, for us. So if we can figure out what it takes to continue to keep the economy growing at the rate that it has, you know, that's another thing that I would say is a concern that I think about is, hey, make sure I've got somebody to sell to.
Chris, this is my last comment, and then we've got to go. I heard this comment. I can't take authorship, but this person said, if you're in an HR position, if you're, as you just talked about, looking for people,
mm-hmm.
the person made the comment, which I thought was, I chuckled a little bit at the comment. He said, if you're sitting down and you're talking to people and their resume says they have a college degree that ends in the word studies, don't hire them. Because they're not going to be able to help you. People who are studying something are not, they're not bachelors in business administration or mathematicians or engineers. Their degree is not something that they can bring into the work environment and be productive. What do you think about hiring people, and are you willing to take the chance of hiring people right out of college with whether they have a degree in studies or something else who have no experience?
Well, I'll give you – well, the thing – one of the big things for me is somebody's ability to learn, right? And most colleges are examples if people are able to, matriculate and graduate and get a degree. Hopefully they've demonstrated at least they're able to learn something. So I don't know if I fully get the, what the degree is in. But I will tell you a short story. A young lady on our team was fresh out of college, and she went to school to be a microbiologist researcher. Never coded a day in her life, wouldn't know, in terms of writing, computer code. She went through a program where she took some development classes, and now she's one of our lead developers on our team. So I'm just looking for folks, one, who have the ability to learn, who are curious to learn, and have the will to learn. And from there, the rest of it just comes, because I most of my jobs I've ever gotten in my life, I didn't know what I was supposed to do until after I got in the job. So I'm always saying, hey, if you got the will, the curiosity, and the capacity to learn, let's get to it.
Back to you, Don.
Boy, Chris, that's the last word. We've been talking with Chris Powell. We could go on and on. We have been talking with Chris Powell, who's CEO of Telemetrics. His company is about how small businesses can add profits with an effective wellness plan. A link to his website will be on our webpage, www.recalculating.biz, tonight. Thank you so much, Chris, for being with us.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Glad to be here. Thanks, guys. Are we still there?
We're done, Chris. You can hang up.
We got Rob Arnold on, ready to go after 5 seconds.
You,
Chris,
all
you
right,
can listen
I'll let
in
you guys go.
If you want
there
to,
you
or
go.
You can go.
No,
thank
I'm going
to
run on. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Go back to the meeting, huh? Okay, 5 seconds. Rob, are you all set?
I am.
Hi, Rob. This is Dan Perkins. How are you?
I'm well, and yourself?
Fine, thank you, and thank you for joining us today. Looking forward to it. Thank
okay,
you.
Fellas, I Absolutely. Need 5 seconds.
Okay.
Silence. Dan, we have been talking a lot about the threat of hackers and ransomware thieves affecting small businesses. When we saw this new book, Cybersecurity, A Business Solution, by Rob Arnold, we had to invite him on the program. Rob, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Rob, I'm going to start off by asking about your book, and ask you to outline for our audiences the basic premise of your book.
All right. The premise of my book is that cybersecurity is actually a business problem, not just an IT problem. It also encourages executives to look at what happens after an attack and invest in solutions like legal review and insurance policies that can save companies that get hacked despite elaborate preventive controls.
Rob, well, that's a good start.
Yeah.
Dan, you go on from there.
Thank you. Rob, thank you for joining us. I'm interested in it's a business solution. We just had a reported experience last week with another cybersecurity break of virtually every customer of Yahoo. Did you see that report?
I'm aware of that.
Yeah. So when your entire system is corrupt, I guess it is a business solution because you're trying to figure out how you can keep your customers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, the book kind of explains cyber attacks create this cash flow storm in which expenses are rising and revenues are falling. And as much as business owners want to prevent attacks, they've also got to be prepared to manage the cash flow. So the smart play is really to practice good basic hygiene and to do things today that are going to manage the cash flow when those basic controls fail to keep the bad guys out. And I can give you some examples if you'd like.
Sure.
Good basic hygiene means things like encrypting sensitive communications, training employees to spot phishing attacks, and applying security patches to computers in a timely manner. But the other half of your time and effort really needs to be spent planning to deal with the cash flow problems that that crop up when the basic hygiene fails. Because after an attack, it's too late to buy insurance or have your attorney revise contracts to limit your liability. So, similarly, with ransomware, if you don't have good system backups in place before the attack, they can't really be there to help you recover from it. And so the book kind of offers a step-by-step approach to managing this process and kind of monitoring it over time. And it even suggests some ways where you might be able to increase market share and profits by embracing cybersecurity.
Rob, where can we get your book?
The book's available on Amazon. I'm working on getting it available in Google Books. Google Books stopped taking new authors for a short period of time, so I'm working on that right now, so we'll have a digital copy. And then, of course, you can go to the book's website. It's cybersecurityabusinesssolution.com, and we actually have a discount if you sign up for our newsletter, and that would save you about the shipping costs on the book.
How long have you been in this space?
Well, I spent 10 years as a consultant to small, medium, and large companies, and then I went back to graduate school and focused on answering two questions that came out of that experience, which no one seemed to be able to answer, which is, how much should you spend on cybersecurity, and how much security is actually enough? So those are the two questions I focused on in graduate school, and the book is really a culmination of that knowledge. And then I also founded ThreatSketch as a company to provide this critical risk assessment tool that you need to answer those two questions.
We saw the Yahoo X meltdown of their entire system, and
yep.
they weren't as forthcoming as they might have been. In fact, their history has been that they've not been as forthcoming with other hacks. But my question, you, in your answer to the other question, you talked about small, medium, and large businesses.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of numbers, there are infinitely many, many, many times small businesses than there are medium or large businesses. What are the challenges for the small business that they're not paying attention to that's leaving them so vulnerable?
So the difference between the large companies and the small companies are, one, it's a matter of resources. Obviously, large companies have more dollars to throw at the problem. But what happens is when the larger companies shore themselves up against certain types of attacks, the hackers turn to automation. And it's almost the same economics that drives spam, right? You can go out with an automated attack and try and phish W-2s from 1,000 companies, and you can do it for pennies on the dollar. And so if you only get one or two companies to send you their employee W-2s, it still makes financial sense for them. So there's this economic incentive for the hackers to just try and find the people who aren't doing anything in order to protect themselves. And there's so many small businesses out there that aren't doing it, it makes it lucrative for them. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. They just don't pay attention to it.
Yeah.
Dan, could I jump in and ask, what are two or three things, Rob, you would suggest, are the minimum small businesses should do to protect themselves?
Well, that's kind of a moving target. But right now, I think one of the most important things that small businesses can do is look into two-factor authentication for every account that they have, including email and banking. And two-factor authentication is that thing where you put in your password, but then you're required to also enter a small code that comes off of either a token that you carry, or it's texted to you in, on your smartphone, or sometimes there's an app on your smartphone that generates the code. But that's kind of the baseline right there. And then the next thing you need to look at is determining what of your data is really sensitive. In terms of, you know, what would the liability be to you if it was lost? And I go back to that W-2 example where a W-2, you know, operationally it's not worth a whole lot of money to the business, but to the employee when it gets lost, it's worth a fortune, and it also exposes the business to a lot of liability. So finding those key pieces of data that could either that either are worth a lot to your revenue stream or they represent a huge risk in terms of liability, and then locking those down with encryption and making sure only the people that absolutely need to know have access to that information. So those are kind of the basic things.
Well, in this world, especially small business, bring your own device is something that's become popular, where employees use their own devices. And that seems to be a vulnerable point for many of these attackers. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, small businesses like to keep their employees on call all the time, and having them have their smartphones with all their business information at their fingertips is a wonderful productivity boost. But the flip side is, of course, it creates this liability that nobody was really expecting. So the best thing you can do is have good mobile device management system in place where you can lock down or wipe any kind of stolen cell phone or smartphone or tablet device as it goes if it gets compromised. And the other thing is to enforce good passwords on there. And so your mobile device management software will let you enforce those rules even on phones that aren't owned by you.
Dan, back to you.
Yeah, I just need to go back and clarify what you just said. Is that you? Are you saying that an individual could have a business, could have liability off of somebody else's phone? A customer phone?
Not off a customer's phone, but off of the employee's phone. So if you've given an employee sensitive data on their phone and that gets out, that's where the liability comes into play.
I see. I don't mean to be overly critical of my contemporaries, but by and large, are small business people too busy to really pay a serious amount of attention to cybersecurity?
You know, they are incredibly busy, and they're incredibly focused on even more fundamental things like making payroll, right? That's what they really worry about from day to day. But, you know, with the stories that have come out in the news recently, we've definitely seen an uptick in small business owners wanting to make an investment. But, of course, the solutions can be quite expensive sometimes. And you know, any good small business owner is not going to want to just go out and invest money in something that they don't know what the return on that investment is going to be. And ironically enough, that's the exact problem we try to solve for these small businesses, is to say, okay, let's look at this from a financial standpoint and figure out what would the return on investment be for a given investment. So it's almost like doing a break-even analysis, but you're doing it on what you aren't going to lose instead of what you will gain. And that gets a little, it's very complex, but you can make some good decisions if you have good data and a good person to help you interpret that data.
I'm not going to put you on the spot by asking you about a specific company as much as I'm going to ask you about that I see, and I'm sure Don sees it all the time. I would say more frequently than weekly, I get these invasions in my system who want to clean up all the corrupt files and do all this stuff, and just click here and we'll do it, and you've got 961, 1150 or 325
right.
that need to be. And are these systems worth anything?
No. The vast majority of them are simply scams getting you to load software on your machine, but then they can take control of that machine and every other one on your network and use those in botnets that they can use to attack other companies and listen to your communications.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are by and large, and I can't say that all of them are, you know, I think there are some well-meaning companies out there, but by and large, avoid those like the plague.
I had a problem with my computer, and I called Apple, and they have this thing now where they can actually see your computer, go in and look at it, remote processing, and they got rid of all of these things that had snuck into my computer, and they said that the Apple in and of itself has great cybersecurity, and when these things come into your system, they actually degrade the quality of security that you have with Apple. And what I'm curious about, not everybody works on Apple. A lot of people work on PCs. Is there a particular software for a small business that is a kind of a basic software package that you like that could help provide some level of security that you could recommend?
I don't recommend specific packages, but I do have some guidelines, and that is, first of all, to make sure that you trust the origin of the software. So there are big manufacturers like Avast and McAfee and Symantec that are out there that are fairly well known, you really want to try, if for a U.S.-based company anyway, you want to stay with a U.S.-based security provider. Even the federal government recently has decided to remove all the Kaspersky software off of their computers because of their tie to the Russian government. And you can imagine that it's not a very good idea to have someone in a nation state with whom we don't have exactly copacetic relationships providing security software. And small business owners need to make that same decision. So figuring out who you want to trust is probably the most important piece rather than which individual software package you decide to go with.
Dan, can I interrupt just for a minute?
Sure.
We're talking with Rob Arnold. His book is Cybersecurity, A Business Solution. We will be back with more with Rob after this word from our sponsor. We're talking with Rob Arnold. He's written a book. He's an expert on cybersecurity, and it's called Cybersecurity, A Business Solution. Back to you, Dan.
Yeah, Rob, I'm concerned about as we look at what's happening on the global stage, what are your sense of the cybersecurity threats from China and North Korea and some of those Asian nations? Is it real or is it hype?
No, I think there's absolutely a great deal of concern out there, and for small businesses as well. Cyber espionage, just like the Cold War that we went through in the nuclear era, was really one of economics, right? We raised the bar in terms of defense so high that it bankrupted our foes. And they learned from that, and so did other people that are watching us. And so cybersecurity on the world stage is a game of economics, and stealing trade secrets, you know, getting access to the SEC filings, which happened recently, so that people can make trades on the stock market with insider knowledge. All of those things are of deep concern from a global perspective.
This is fascinating, Dan. If I can jump in with a question while you're thinking. You know, many small, what do you do after with ransomware and with, well, let's start with ransomware, where they lock up your computer and say you have to pay a fee. What is there any prevention you can do beforehand, and is there anything you can do afterwards?
Well, the important things to do ahead of time are, one, have good solid backups, and those need to be disconnected from the system itself, because if you're just backing up to, let's say, a USB-attached hard drive, well, they'll encrypt that too, and so now they've encrypted your backup and your hard drive. So in this case, a cloud-based backup that's disconnected from your system makes a lot of sense, and you need to time that so that you don't lose more work than the latest backup. So if you only, you know, if a week's worth of work isn't that big a deal to learn, I mean, to lose, then, you know, you set your backups for every week. If losing a day's worth of work is super critical, you may actually go down and have hourly backups done to make sure that you're protected. And then the other thing that you want to do is train yourself and your employees to avoid phishing attacks, which are kind of the most common avenue for installing ransomware, is to send you some link, you know, an email with some link on it that looks fascinating, you know, either and we click on it and we follow the prompts, and the next thing you know, we have the ransomware notice popping up saying, yeah, you have to send us, you know, so many Bitcoin, or we're going to delete all your files. And then in the aftermath of that, I highly recommend involving your local police department. The local authorities really need to help guide you through this and make sure that, you know, for one thing, you shouldn't be paying the ransom, because all you're doing is inviting them to come and do it again. And second of all, we need to develop a pattern. We need to find what the patterns are for these ransomware attacks. And by reporting that to the authorities, we get to build kind of a model to say, okay, well, this is how they're getting into the systems across the United States. What can we do to prevent those? So unless you participate in sharing that information, then it makes it harder for us good guys to try and figure out broad-based solutions. Does that kind of answer your question?
Oh, very, very definitely. I have a lot more, but Dan, back to you.
Thank you. Rob, you talk about cybersecurity, a business solution. So if I'm a small business, what percentage of my overhead should be spent on cybersecurity in terms of dollars and cents?
Right, and that's kind of a hard target to hit. You kind of have to back into it from your actual exposure, and the book lays out the process for getting to that. And I wish I could tell you it was as simple as saying, well, you should, you know, allocate 5% or 2% of your overhead, but it's a little more nuanced than that. Now, if you just need kind of a ballpark, well, what are some good numbers to start with? You start with your IT budget, whatever that is. Let's say that you spend 5% of your overhead on IT, whether it's cloud services, servicing the hardware and software that you have, buying new hardware on a 3 or 5 year cycle, and then use somewhere between 5% and 20% of that number is what you should be spending on cybersecurity. And there is this academic there's this academic limit that the Gordon Lebb model kind of predicts that once you've determined the value of your intangible assets or the assets that are, you know, being protected in terms of cybersecurity, no more than 37% of that value should be spent on cybersecurity, because after that, it's the point of diminishing returns, that you're better off then at that point just preparing for the inevitable attack.
But one of the things that concerns me, and I'm a novelist, I write fiction, and I wrote a trilogy on radical Islamic nuclear terrorism. Mm-hmm. And I talked about the destruction of the cloud service system through the use of nuclear devices exploded in the atmosphere above above the earth. And we're talking about that in real time. I wrote that in 2012. We're talking about that in real time today, is that one of the threats of North Korea is that they could send a nuclear device up into the atmosphere on its way supposedly to the United States, but create a electromagnetic pulse which could destroy the internet and more specifically the backup in the cloud in the server farms. Does that give you any concern?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a concern that we have now. It's interesting, the way the internet was originally designed, it was actually designed specifically to withstand a nuclear attack. The way we've gone about making the internet more efficient from a cost standpoint, we've kind of gotten away from some of the basic tenets of the original internet in terms of its interconnectivity, so that if you blew out any one section of it, it would just automatically repair itself and route around the damage. So there's some concern about that. If you really want to make sure that you're protected against an attack like that, your best bet is to use multiple cloud providers and splitting your data across multiple providers, because the physical data will reside in different data centers across the United States. So you're basically playing a game of saying, well, okay, if North Korea detonates a device over California and they take out all the West Coast data centers, then at least the East Coast data centers will keep up and going. And even Google and Amazon have some of that redundancy built in. But for sure, if there's ever a physical cyber attack like that, we're going to pay a pretty steep price in terms of our productivity and not being able to conduct business as we do on a normal day-to-day basis.
So let me move to a more mundane question.
Okay.
What is the challenge in cybersecurity when we have so many employees that have access to the internet and use it for other than business purposes?
Yeah, I wish I had a magic bullet answer to that. It really comes down to setting policies and setting cultural tones, and all of that comes from the business owner. The business owner has to make a clear distinction that, okay, you're at work, you're using this computer, which I've given you to use for business purposes, and to keep us all safe, please don't do your personal computing on that. Now, the degree to which you monitor and enforce that is, again, something that goes along with the culture of the company. And some companies thrive on allowing their employees a great deal of freedom. Some companies are very concerned about locking down everything that goes through there, because they've made a commitment, much like banks have to their client, of, hey, you give us your information just like you give your money to a bank and we'll keep it safe. So it really depends on the business that you're in and what kind of culture you're trying to foster within your organization.
I hate to break this up. It's been illuminating. We're talking with Rob Arnold. He's written a very fascinating book, Cybersecurity, A Business Solution. Rob, tell us how people can find you and your book.
They can find the book at cybersecurityabusinesssolution.com. And my company is Threat Sketch, a funny little name that we came up with, and our website is threatsketch.com.
Can you spell it out?
Yes.
And Rob, I'm interrupting you. Spell it out, please.
Yes, I will. Threat Sketch is THREATSKETCH cybersecurityinfo.com.
We have to ask, how did you come up with that name?
Well, it's very hard in this day and age to find a good, short, somewhat catchy name that for which the domain has not already been, a domain name has not already been snatched up by someone. So we went through several different iterations, and we liked the idea that basically we're making a thumbnail sketch of the threats that a business faces. And so that kind of concept caught on, and from there we picked the name and went after the trademark and purchased the internet domain and so forth. So that's how that came to be.
Well, as a fellow author, and Dan is too, what did you think about naming your book that?
You mean picking the name Cybersecurity, a Business Solution?
I'm calling it Threat Sketch, which is a very catchy name.
Gotcha. Well, you know, I kind of look at our – the reason I didn't is I look at the product that we make at Threat Sketch, which is a cyber risk assessment, specifically a strategic cyber risk assessment. So I look at that as the Threat Sketch, and really the book is an entire process for which – Our little product is one piece of that larger puzzle. So I needed a more encompassing name for the book since it covered a lot more than just doing strategic risk assessments and how those get made. And nobody really wants to see how that sausage factory works. So that's why I didn't name the book after the company.
We've been talking with Rob Arnold. We wanted to sign off, but he brought up some other interesting points. It's Cybersecurity, a Business Solution by Rob Arnold. Thank you, Rob. Thank you so much for joining us. I know I learned a lot. I think Dan did, and I hope our audience did as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
That's it, Bob. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Y'all have a wonderful afternoon.
Same to you. Thank you for calling in.
Sure. Bye now.
Well, Dan, what do you think about our guest today, and what do you learn?
Well, I think that I was really impressed with Marshall and Rob both. Marshall obviously is an industry leader and very much involved, and I think he gave all of us, including me, a lot of information and advice, and on the opportunities presented to be in podcasting, and at the same time, Rob helped us with small business to understand that even small businesses have to be concerned about security.
Well, you know, when I listened to Rob, I was going through all of the things that I was doing wrong. And also, unfortunately, probably I'm going to continue. But the best part about Marshall was the fact that he really laid out that we're in the right space at the right time. Even for two older guys, we're still in a young industry, which is nice to be.
Yeah, I was impressed with that. His vision is that this is in the early stages and it's going to be explosive and perhaps may dominate over-air broadcasting at some time in the future, maybe before we get done. He sees things and he has great vision, and I hope our audience learned something from both of them. It was a good program, and I enjoyed having them on and trying to draw out information from both of them.
Well, until next time, this is Don Mazzella.
And Dan Perkins, and thank you for joining us. And by the way, if you missed all of this program, you can go back to our website, recalculating.biz, and pick up not only this program, but past programs, And you can also listen to Tips of the Day and other features and look for special offers coming at recalculating.biz.